Welcome to Financial Repression Authority's Roundtable Insight, where the best fund managers, economists, and industry leaders discuss the key investment issues and challenges in the current macroeconomic environment.
Hi, welcome to FRA's Roundtable Insight. This is Richard Benulli. Today we have Bill Lagner. He's principal and co-founder of Baring Asset Management. He and his managing partner, Kevin Duffy, manage the Baring Fund using an Austrian School of Economics lens in terms of identifying boom-bust cycles, value in the marketplace, bubbles, and distortions created by both fiscal and monetary authorities. The fund was one of the top-performing macro funds during the last bubble implosion in 07-09, and the Baring Asset Management has created the Baring Credit Bubble Index, which features the various enablers of the last bubble beginning in 2004-2005. Bill has been featured in Barron's, Reuters, CFA Magazine, and Business Insider. Welcome, Bill.
Richard, thank you for having me.
Great. I thought today we'd do a focus on the promise of blockchain technology and also what led to that, how we got to there, and what the role of central banks in terms of their distortions, how it has led us to this point. So maybe you could begin by giving us a little bit of history and background on that. That would be great.
Yeah, thank you. So, look, I think after the credit bubble burst in 09 and we watched the various central banks put Humpty Dumpty back on the wall by going to negative interest rates in the first time in over 5,000 years, you know, one of the things you have when you have a black swan like that, you typically get kind of a subset of these unintended consequences. One of the things that emerged from that is Bitcoin and the blockchain. And I had a couple people introduce me to this back in 2011 and initially spent some time looking at it, didn't really start taking it seriously till about 2012. And then you started to see, you know, just to give your listeners a little background. So the blockchain essentially is this distributed ledger technology. You have basically multiple copies. It's a database, essentially. There's multiple copies of the database, and you have these nodes or miners that are essentially mining and verifying information through a series of algorithms. And what happens is you create these tokens, what they call Bitcoin, and you have basically a permissionless, instant or close to instant, free way of just transferring value, you know, from one participant to another. And when you think about it, you know, it sounds kind of basic, but when you think about around the world, how many people are unbanked or underbanked, and then the various intermediaries that charge, you know, roughly, I computed this, roughly 3% of global GDP is just friction by, you know, a fiat currency, wire fees, credit card fee, all the other different fees, right, when we're trying to move value from one entity to another. Some of these countries, the numbers are multiples of that. It could be as much as 10 or 15%. And cab drivers in New York spent a lot of time in New York the last 3 years and just sending money back to Africa or some of these, you know, very far-flung places, their families, it could take 12, 13%. It would take 3 to 4 days before their wife would actually get money. And so Bitcoin became kind of this positive black swan. And I would view it as the first, it's almost like the Netscape of the internet. The Netscape was the first real browser that took many of us onto the internet in a more formal, simplistic way. Yeah. I would say Bitcoin essentially was that kind of aha moment for me. And, you know, started looking at various companies, business models, et cetera, and allocated resources to several of them, which we can get into in a moment. But I think the main thrust here is that we've had the internet of information, and now we're moving into the internet of value. And I think it's one of the most transformative things that you and I will see in our lifetime.
And so what has been the background behind this in terms of the drivers of central banks?
Yeah. Yeah. So the central banks, I mean, let's face it, when central banks of the, let's say Japan, Europe, US, smaller, lesser degree places like China, and other countries, they essentially went to negative, you know, zero and or negative interest rate policy. So they're basically sending a signal to the world that fiat currency doesn't have much value because we can print it out of thin air. And then they went on in 2013-14 and took it to a whole new extreme by buying up not just bonds, but buying up stocks. And Bank of Japan, the Swiss Central Bank, were big buyers of equities. You had the European Central Bank last year buying junk bonds at negative interest rates. And so all of those things have led to just a plethora of distortions. And what's happened is essentially is you've created so much distrust and unease in the system that people started saying, we've got to create alternative ways of storing and sending value. And so Bitcoin, as I mentioned, was the first. Ethereum came along several years ago, and Ethereum is another operating protocol. It's a little different than, I don't want to get into too much of the minutia on the technology behind both, but same thesis of a distributed ledger, and the difference is Ethereum actually has people that are building decentralized apps on top of the operating protocol. And so an example of this would be something like a ride-sharing application. So instead of Uber taking 80%, the driver getting 20%, a decentralized ride-sharing application turns it around where the driver gets 80 and the decentralized app infrastructure gets 20. So essentially, you start creating a much more localized economy. And what you do is you start moving value away from large centralized platforms into a very decentralized ecosystem. And that has, when you really think about it, and I've spent a lot of time and analysis on this, this has far-reaching implications beyond anything we could probably even cover on your show or subsequent shows. It's a lot to digest, but I think most people can see what we're in the early stages. I mean, I think we're in what I think will be a almost like a parallel universe to the centralized system that we've grown up around.
And one of those implications is essentially the elimination or minimization of the middleman or middle person. Can you explain how that happens?
Yeah, that's a great question. So, you know, for years, right, we would store money at a bank and you know, they would tell you the rules. This is what the fees are and these are the services we're going to provide. And then, you know, you go do your bank wire or your business transactions through there and they end up, you know, providing services, charging a fee, and they end up as a central clearing party. Well, with blockchain, you don't need that, right? You don't need that middleman. So this peer-to-peer value transfer, and a person can be anywhere as long as they have an internet connection. People create these digital wallets. These digital wallets allow you to hold fiat currency. Some wallets allow you to hold a bevy of cryptocurrencies and or gold or silver. Some are launching other types of stores of value. And what happens is people are just exchanging value as simple as sending an email or a text message. And again, I mentioned the amount of friction that we've witnessed globally from these intermediaries. And the challenge is, you know, nothing happens. It's not that simple. I mean, the challenge is that it's very clunky. It's very, during the Christmas holidays, I had someone send me $300 of Bitcoin and it took about 2.5 days to get to me and they had to pay $20 to send it to me. That's because the network was very busy.
Wow.
And they were basically, I don't want to get again into technology, but the group around Bitcoin were contemplating another fork, which is where a group of engineers kind of fork off and create a different version of the original protocol. Anyway, look, that was kind of an anomaly. Prior to that, it was pretty inexpensive. And today it's pretty inexpensive to send something on the Bitcoin blockchain. But this is no different than the internet getting rid of travel agents and full service brokerage companies, right? Stock brokerage businesses, same kind of disruption. And again, I think what people need to understand is that value gets pushed back into the local consumer's hand or local business's hand, and not to these large centralized platforms.
In terms of the friction you mentioned, has some of this been due to issues with government regulations and essentially the government not being able to get a cut out of the transaction? Is that an issue?
Yeah, that's a good point. So banks and central banks, let's face it, central banks have been highly political animals of the establishments of governments. And look, governments issue fiat currency, and that fiat currency is not backed by anything today. So it's only backed by the faith and the ability of government to minimize and plan economies, minimize inflation, collect taxes, and stimulate economic activity. But central planning, as you and I both know, has never worked, and there's always a subset of unintended consequences. I think governments are today witnessing the responses of various governments. Some have banned cryptocurrencies, and it's funny, Russia and or China was the first to ban Bitcoin, and then Bitcoin usage skyrocketed in that particular country. So the point is, the genie's out of the bottle. They're not going to be able to ban it. So then the question is, do they regulate and or tax it? And in certain countries, they view it as a commodity. And so your gains or losses have to be recognized. And then in other countries, they're still contemplating, you know, is this a currency? Is it a commodity? And it's very fluid. It's very, very dynamic at this point. The CFTC and the SEC has basically tried to lightly regulate the space. I actually think that there's so much innovation now happening in the space that they're not going to shut it down. They're going to allow it to proliferate, but I think there will be certain basic things like anti-money laundering, know your customer. You don't want to have a situation, for example, with Twitter or Facebook where you have all these fake accounts happening. So there has to be real value being transferred and then real accounts being held by these different entities.
And yeah, you mentioned cryptocurrency as an application of blockchain. I know of others as well in terms of like client onboarding, client profiling, model portfolio management, order generation, integrated messaging. These are applications that are actually real and tangible today. So it's not pie in the sky. But turning back to cryptocurrencies as an application of blockchain, do you think that governments will allow private-based cryptocurrencies to continue to coexist alongside government currencies in the long term? Will that be allowed?
I mean, it's very difficult to make that prediction. I do think that right now the innovation cycle will be allowed to proliferate. Now, again, what will the rules be in the future from this technology revolution? It's very difficult to say. I mean, it's interesting, right? Japan is essentially they've been in a liquidity trap for 29 years, over 29 years now, and they've essentially made Bitcoin legal tender. And what's happening is you're actually getting economic activity to pick up in Japan, and consumer confidence has actually picked up in Japan. And it's almost like a gift for the Japanese government. So I think it's going to vary from country to country. I think at the end of the day, if economic activity increases because people feel like there's inclusiveness, they're getting a fair shake, as opposed to certain parts of the world where they're taxed so much that you get the economy either moving underground or people don't want to participate in the economy, period. They just sit on their savings and move on with their day. I mean, it'll be a fascinating, we have a front row seat to it. It's going to be a fascinating movie to watch unfold, but yeah, I just think they allow it for quite a while, and then we'll just see. Think about it. If they can create economic activity and they can also generate tax revenue like the internet. I mean, the internet's been, it's another source of tax revenue, but it also has driven lots of commerce. And I think at the end of the day, governments like commerce because they can tax it.
And what about the issue of property rights in blockchain-related applications? Is that an ongoing concern? What has been done to date in that area?
Yeah, that's a good question as well. So there have been several people speaking about this topic, certain countries that have never really had private property rights, and the whole idea of having that be part of the blockchain. These are smaller countries, by the way, that have had these lengthy discussions. And so I think we're in the early stages of that. I think that is another part of this inclusiveness thesis. Think about it. I mean, for since the beginning of central banking, we've been in a world where debt has driven some of this private property illusion. People get debt and then they end up buying, let's say, a piece of real estate. They think they have private property, but you know, then the taxing authorities tax you. So it's a very complex issue. I think when you take a step back and look at blockchain private property rights, I think at the end of the day, governments are going to move towards a position where they welcome the blockchain as it assists in this private property rights movement. And it's about inclusiveness. I mean, you've had a, think about it. You have, there's a lot of poverty around the world, and that poverty, part of the poverty is driven by a lack of private property rights. And part of that poverty is driven by fiat currency, right? And the demise of these central banking experiments. So I think they go hand in hand. We're early in that process, but I do see a lot of very favorable discussions coming from different parts of the world.
And given the coming proliferation of blockchain-based applications, could the government take an approach to more control, to provide more control or apply more control on those applications and transactions in terms of controlling the economy, controlling transactions, or even promoting certain industries and sectors of the economy?
Yeah, that's clearly that's one of the greatest risks to this movement. There's no question that, too much regulation, potential taxes, et cetera, on these activities could lead to, well, there's several things that can happen. If that were to occur, let's say 5 years down the road, you could actually see more of the economic activity just move in a digital way underground. And the government doesn't want that, right? They want, as I mentioned earlier, they like commerce, they like to tax commerce. So it's a balance. Governments also don't want the natives becoming restless. They want the natives to be happy, and they want them to be conducting their lives in a very, human way. So that's a risk, no question about it. I think we're so early in the game that we probably shouldn't even be concerned about that today. But, 3 to 5 years from now, that could be a risk. But let's be honest. I mean, the government has to be very careful. If they the genie's out of the bottle. It's like the internet. The blockchain revolution is underway. There's no question about that. The question is, if they overstep their bounds, do these applications that you're referencing, do them move privately, underground, fully peer-to-peer? And if that happens, then you end up starving government. And so they have to be very careful. And look, again, we have a front row seat to just a very exciting time. Mm-hmm.
And finally, how can investors invest in the space, not mentioning specific companies or specific securities, but generally, how can investors get in the space? Does it make sense in the private equity world or public equity world, or what other ways can investors get into this?
Okay, so full disclosure, this is not investment advice. I think we're so early in the process that there will be a lot of money lost. And in fact, I would say that over 90, let's say about 90 to 92% of what's been introduced versus these initial coin offerings or token offerings, a lot of these are, they're people that have never run a business. They don't understand, they may understand facets of technology, but they don't know how to commercialize that technology. You know, the trick is you're taking a whole new technology. You have a technology background, Richard, so you understand this. You're taking a new technology. You're having to filter it down to where the masses can adopt it and use it. So you've got to make it grandma simple. And then you've got the regulatory issues that to dance through. And then beyond that, you're going to have lots of competition because there was over $5 billion, you know, allocated to this space the last 18 months. That's a lot of capital. Now, I also will say there's a lot of people saying we're in a crypto bubble. And I would say far from it. I would say that even if Bitcoin were to go to $1,000 tomorrow, right now the whole space is $330 billion, $40 billion. It's nothing. It's nothing. I mean, the internet went to $5 trillion before it blew up. And from the internet came wonderful businesses, right? You have these bubbles, and the bubbles are a function of all of the excess created by central banks. But look, if 90% of this is just noise, they're people raising $5 or $10 million, but they've never built an application. They don't know how to build community. They don't know how to get technology adoption. They don't know how to build a business. Then sift through all those and throw those to the side. I would suggest doing what I've done, which has helped me, and that's I've attended, you know, a number of conferences. I've spoken to some of the smartest people around the world in the space. And by meeting with people and going through a series of quantitative and qualitative analysis, you can get an idea of some of the potential success stories. No guarantees. But again, it's all about risk management, and I like to look at things quantitatively and qualitatively. I'm excited. I'm fascinated by the space. I think there are brilliant people coming into the space, getting the business models right, getting the incentives aligned properly, getting the token economics right. I mean, these tokens are essentially just digital property, digital networks, and those networks are only as good as the people using them. Unlike the 90s, you know, where it was highly competitive, dog eat dog, what I've noticed in the space is there's a lot of cooperation. People want to partner with other people. That is very refreshing, and I think it's one of the reasons why the space will have serious legs in the next, call it, 1 to 5 years.
And so does it make sense to look at public equity or private equity funds?
Yeah, I'm sorry. Let me get into that. So, look, I think there really are no public companies that are, you know, in my mind, that have even come to the market that are quote-unquote blockchain companies. I mean, a lot of them may not go public. They just may do a token sale or a private equity sale and build their blockchain as a service, you know, project and go it alone. You're going to have lots of blockchains. You're going to have hundreds and maybe thousands of blockchains. So then the question will be, how do all these different blockchains interact with one another? For this to really become seismic, you're going to need interoperability. You're going to need security. You're going to need scalability. You're going to need transparency. And then you're going to have the regulatory, dynamic to deal with. But I think there are really no public companies, so I wouldn't even, this is just my opinion, I wouldn't even spend time there. These initial coin offerings, I think most of them are shady actors, just to be kind. I wouldn't even give these people more than 2 minutes. I think you want to focus on, like, and this is not investment advice, but this is kind of an interesting project that I've followed and I've invested a little capital in. So there's a company called Brave Software, the basic attention token. And again, this is not investment advice. This is a guy that was one of the founders of JavaScript. He's built a business before. He's a proven technologist. And the whole thesis was create a browser, have elements of privacy where you can not allow anyone to look at what you're browsing. But if you do want to allow someone, an advertiser, to watch what, let's say you're getting the New York Yankees highlights from last night, you can click a button on the browser and these different groups can peer into your browsing activity and get some of your profile information, your age, maybe where you live, et cetera. But they're paying you in a token for that information. So instead of Mark Zuckerberg, who's made a fortune hijacking your personal identity and selling it off to various groups, right? This way you're flipping the table and you get paid for it. And that token then becomes, it's traded on different exchanges. You could trade it in for dollars or Bitcoin or maybe some other token. So the tokenization of digital networks and blockchains, we're going from the internet of networks to the internet of blockchains. Mm-hmm. And these business models are just now being concocted, I said, like in the last couple of years. The incentives in some of these networks are profound. I mean, they're actually fascinating. And if you let your mind really open up, you say to yourself, okay, there's a lot of the world that should be decentralized. There's some of the world that's going to stay centralized. And look, the people providing services and the centralization aspect of what they do in the private marketplace, I want to make that clear, you know, earn a fee and that both sides benefit. But I think you're going to see a whole, you know, just wave of a tsunami, actually, of decentralized applications, you know, hit the universe.
Wow. Great insight into the industry, Bill. Thank you very much. How can our listeners learn more about your work and background?
Yeah, so there's you mentioned the Baring Fund and Baring Asset Management. It's just Baring Asset, BaringAsset.com. We also have a blog, BaringAsset.com/blog, and I've got my contact information there. And look, fascinating time. We're very early. And as I said to you earlier, Richard, I think this will be even more exciting than the internet wave.
We'll end it there. Yeah, great. Thank you very much, Bill.
The FRA Roundtable Insight Show is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the show each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Any discussions among the panel participants or responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the panel participants and do not take into consideration the listener's suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Please be advised that you invest or speculate at your own risk.